Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. Now, how's it going out there, my Bitcoiners? Thanks for joining me again today here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. I've got a very timely conversation with macro investor Dan Tapiero for you today. But first, let's check in with Swan, the sponsor of this episode. All right, guys, it's alive. Swan is alive. We've opened the doors to the first couple cohorts of our early access group. If you signed up for early access, you should see your invite in the next few days. We have a lot of live accounts already. We're taking a ton of Satoshis off the market on the reg. We have extremely low fees, especially if you sign up for an annual membership by prepaying your fees. With an annual membership, you can get 0.99% fees when you stack $200 or more worth of Bitcoin per month. By comparison, Coinbase straight up rips you off with a 3.98% fee, and they take a 0.5% spread on buys at that level. Swan is here to make your stacking much more affordable and much easier, and we're good stewards of Bitcoin. We embed the best practices for the blockchain into our product, and we're creating world-class Bitcoin education content. I joined the Swan team because I believe wholeheartedly in this mission. Now, if you can't wait another day or two for your early access invite, or if you never signed up but want in, DM me on Twitter and I'll hook you up because I love you all. Seriously, just DM me. I'll hook you up. You can get in as soon as you DM. And, well, as soon as I, you know, read your DM and am able to respond. All right, let's dive into this episode. Dan Tapiero is the Chief Executive Officer and Managing Partner of IoT Holdings, a fund he is launching that will own private equity of mid to late stage companies operating in the digital asset ecosystem. He's also Managing Partner of DTAP Capital Advisors, a global macro investment fund he launched in 2004 that currently holds his personal investments. He is the co-founder and current board member of Gold Bullion International, an institutional grade physical precious metals platform that is integrated with the world's top wealth managers, custodians, and e-commerce companies. Dan brings this considerable experience in the macro markets to the conversation here at a critical time for the global economy. Let's jump into this discussion with Dan. All right, I'm really excited to welcome Dan Tapiero to the show today. Dan is founder of DTAP Capital and Gold Bullion International, among some other projects that he has going on, which I'm sure he can share with us here in a moment. Dan, how's it going, man?
Good. I mean, just very busy, you know, with these markets, obviously. Yeah, a lot going on and unprecedented stuff as well.
Let's just dive right into it.
I think the predominant thing that's been going on, and I've been tweeting about this a little bit, is that I think we're at a place where the current financial system, the markets are not functioning. There isn't enough liquidity in what are, you know, big markets, the treasury market, corporate bond market. We saw the complete collapse in crude oil, and that led to an unprecedented increase in, you know, the pricing of volatility. The VIX, you know, got up above where it was in 08. So, you know, these markets are frozen, and I'm hoping and contributing to that as well is the strength in the dollar. I mean, one of the most remarkable things of the last few weeks has been that the Fed has, you know, cut rates to zero, but that the real interest rate has risen. The five-year real rate was at minus 80 basis points just, you know, a few weeks ago, and it's now moved up to plus 50 basis points. And so what that means is that the Fed, the easing that the Fed has done has been offset by a drop in inflation expectation. So inflation has gone from, let's say, 1.5 to zero or minus. And so in a way, the markets, and that has led to, in my view, has led to dollar strengthening against numerous currencies. I mean, if you look at it against the BBDXY, which is a basket of 10 currencies, it's up almost 10% in the last 10 days, which is the fastest rate of appreciation, again, since 08. And so just at a time when the markets are in trouble, when they need liquidity, when they need easing to offset some of the economic contraction that we're going to see, the markets are in fact tightening and liquidity is being reduced. And so I've been very aggressive in suggesting that,
Yep, we're still here.
I've been very aggressive in suggesting that the Fed and Trump really, and I know for a lot of Bitcoiners, this is crazy to understand or crazy to think this, but should be aggressively in the markets, not just buying credit and even buying equity and selling dollars through currency intervention. I think these are stopgap measures. Bitcoiners will say, well, they really shouldn't do that. And that's why, there's Bitcoin. And I agree with that, except Bitcoin is $120 billion market cap. And we're talking about tens of trillions of dollars of value having evaporated. The alternative system, the alternative framework that is Bitcoin, maybe one day, can be a proper alternative. I think at the moment, it's just not big enough. And do I think that the systemic problems should lead to a price appreciation in Bitcoin? Absolutely. But even if Bitcoin went up 10 times from here today, it would still just be a $1 trillion market. Right. One-tenth the size of the gold market, a fraction of the size of, global bond and equity market. So it's not really big enough. And so I think the authorities need to be a lot more aggressive by increasing and improving the liquidity conditions in markets. So that's what I've been focusing on.
What are the options though, besides just printing money, lowering interest rates, which, is already being done at levels that are unprecedented, as you mentioned earlier. What else can the central banks and governments do to improve liquidity?
Yeah, I mean, look, there are always things that you can do, and maybe they're not obvious, and maybe they haven't been done before. Maybe it's considered a complete debauching of the currency. I'd say something. Look, Americans, this is an equity culture in America. We care about equity prices. There are very few Americans who care about the dollar or the currency. And again, I'm not saying that this is right. I'm more of a hard money guy. I started a gold business. A big chunk of my wealth is in gold and gold businesses and Bitcoin. And so I am a hard money guy. But that being said, there are a lot of things that can be done to offset some of this collapse in liquidity and dysfunctionality in the markets. And so, like what, for instance? I mean, it's not crazy. The Fed, the Treasury could get together and, for instance, peg the mortgage, the 30-year mortgage rate at 1%. It's now at 3.5%. I'm not saying that would, be the cure-all, but that would certainly be helpful. I think if the dollar goes up another 5-10%, it'll start to really destabilize markets. And then you really need to start thinking about, a Plaza Accord type situation. And the Federal Reserve in the last few days has opened up swap lines with central banks at dollar swap lines that they haven't had lines with. There are existing lines, of course, with the big central banks already, sort of suggesting to me that they're preparing for potentially doing some sort of intervention. But again, it's the Treasury and it's Trump that control dollar policy. Right. And I really think they should start, leaning against the strengthening of the dollar. And I think that would be helpful. So forget for a moment what is the, what is the best thing that they should be doing in a perfect world. I think we're beyond that at this moment. And I'm just advocating for things that I think will be stopgap measures that will give us the time to see us through, this whole virus episode. Is that
so? Oh yeah, go ahead.
No, I was like, is that answer?
That's yeah. That no, that makes sense. Definitely answers my question. No. I was just going to ask though that Raul Powell tweeted recently a couple days ago that he's basically out of the market and all in dollars and Bitcoin right now. Basically under the premise that, you know, dollars are going to be in very high demand and maybe eventually Bitcoin as well as this crisis, you know, moves on over the next year or two. What do you think about that decision? And, you know,
I was DMing with Raul. It was, you know, midnight or so just before he put that tweet out. And then I retweeted it a few minutes later. Because we're of the same mind there. I'm not quite as bullish on the dollar as he is because I see it as an abnormality that will need to be reversed. So, you know, we've had a 10% move in a week. I think, for instance, another 10% move up in the dollar the next week would really almost cause a shutdown of all the global markets. I think the stock market would be crushed. If the dollar had that kind of move. So I don't like to bet on things that while I may think they're likely, I also think that they can be reversed quickly or should be reversed. So we agree on Bitcoin. I mean, as Barry Silver said the other day, like this is why Bitcoin was invented. And he's absolutely right. And there is some belief, and I believe this as well, that there is a trust that's being lost now. The authorities will probably muddle through in the next few weeks, and I think, you know, most likely, look, in the worst case scenario, they have to shut down the markets for a few days or a week or so, something like what happened after September 11th. I mean, if things get really bad, but they'll, you know, we'll muddle through this. But the key point is that people are starting to question whether the existing system really is the best one. How could we have a corporate bond market that is functioning for 11 years and then all of a sudden, I mean, it's been functioning for a long time, but within a matter of 3 or 4 weeks, gives up 11 years worth of gains. It's just remarkable. The speed of this collapse suggests that the existing system, is highly problematic and needs fixing in a way or adjusting or an alternative system. And the only thing that really represents that is Bitcoin. So if you're ever going to be long Bitcoin, you know, for the big macro reason, you know, this would be it. And again, there are many other reasons to be long Bitcoin, and there are many specific things about Bitcoin that, you know, there are many people out there who are more qualified. And, you know, Jan, for instance, who you work with, that book he read, he wrote, I think was a fantastic book for people who are, you know, macro guys like me. And that's Inventing Bitcoin, Jan Pritzker, because he explains things in a simple way. But in an in-depth way enough for people to understand that Bitcoin is truly an innovation and as I call it, an invention that's sort of one of the great inventions of the last 50 years or plus. Yeah. And so, you know, the people on Twitter who are, you know, trying to trade Bitcoin based on a move of, and I would say probably hedge fund people or other traders trying to trade it based on what the equity market does or what gold does. I just think that's sort of misplaced focus. It's going to be very difficult to trade Bitcoin based on traditional macro connections or macro linkages. Bitcoin is its own thing. And, you know, then you'll say, well, why did it drop, you know, 50% in a day? Or, you know, why did it drop from 10 down to, you know, 4, whatever it is? And it suffered just like gold did. It suffered a liquidation. When you're in a liquidation period, all assets, the correlations go to 1 because people just sell anything they have to raise cash.
Right.
And so Bitcoin, you know, suffered as a result of that. But I, you know, I wouldn't then therefore say that every action in the traditional markets will have impact on Bitcoin. I just, you know, it's still a developing asset class. It's still evolving. Very few people, at least in my world or in the bigger institutional money management world, understand it or have positions in it. You know, so I think it is, you know, it is a place where you must have some exposure, and you know, you have the current fundamentals aligning in the traditional world that, you know, support that. But I wouldn't trade one based off the other, right? For me, Bitcoin is an allocation, and I own it, and I will own it for a very long time. I've just decided to allocate a certain percent of my portfolio to Bitcoin, and that's it. And maybe that's too simple-minded, but at the moment, you know, that's sort of my comfort level.
You're a hodler.
I am. I am, and I think it makes most sense. And I don't know of another asset that has as much potential upside. So for me, there's tremendous asymmetry in this bet. I don't think it can go to zero. People say, oh, well, it can go to zero. Well, I think that's impossible at this moment. I think maybe, you know, could it go to 2,000 or 3,000? You know, sure. But, you know, it could also go to 300,000 or 400,000. And you just don't see that kind of bet line up. And I say that not, you know, pie in the sky. I've been involved with Bitcoin since 2014. My gold company integrated with a company called BitReserve, which today is Uphold, in 2014, and we became the first place you could buy and sell physical gold to buy and sell Bitcoin and Ripple. And, you know, I was aware of it. I was focused on it a little bit. But, you know, I didn't quite fall down the rabbit hole in that 14 period. And, you know, the firm was making little bits of money on commissions from it, and I was aware of it, but I didn't really dig deep until the first quarter of 19. I mean, it took several years. Mm-hmm. And the price collapsed in the first quarter. And I then thought, okay, well, there's an opportunity here, an asset that I like that goes down 80-90%, usually is a bust, or it's a great buying opportunity. And that's when I really started doing all the work in a deep way, at least within my analytical framework. I'm not a venture capitalist. I'm not a technologist. I'm not particularly good even with computers, you know. So I had to come to an understanding of what Bitcoin is, but within my own framework. And that, you know, that takes a long time. And I, as I said on that Raul interview, that Real Vision interview I did last summer, it was basically 10 hours a day for 6 months.
Yeah.
So that's the way that I think about that bet and how I have it structured.
Yeah, that's not a, you know, not an uncommon story. This is kind of the Bitcoiner's journey that you get. Often you'll run into it a time or two before you really take it seriously. And then once you do, and that's why we call it falling down the rabbit hole or the orange pill, which is kind of the reference to the Matrix, it just sucks you in. It has tremendous gravity. And then you just, you know, want to know everything. So when you were going through this process, you know, I guess you're in the midst of about a year ago now, what resources did you find most helpful when you were coming up to speed?
Yeah. I mean, look, I mentioned Jan's book, you know, the Antonopoulos book, the Internet of Money, volume 2, was really helpful to me. Safe's book, was very helpful. It's well known, obviously. The Bitcoin Standard. And then probably, you know, there were several hundred articles I read on Medium, and then Twitter. I mean, Twitter really is where the community lives. And, you know, barring a few people who are sort of adversarial or overly emotional about their opinions. It's a great place to engage and interact with people. You can ask any question to, you know, to the people out there, the crowd out there, and you'll get, you know, of course you'll get some poor, you know, not well thought out answers, but for the most part, you can find really the smartest guys in the space will respond to you, and you can have a dialogue with them. And so I learned a lot through reading and then dialogue on Twitter. And I had never done Twitter until, last year, sort of August or so. And I thought, look, I'm 51. I don't know. There aren't too many of my friends, at least, you know, in the world that I'm coming from, the global macro hedge fund investor world, that look at Twitter at all or have Twitter even. And I know it sounds ridiculous for people in the Bitcoin space, but it's just there's a serious bifurcation, which I've talked a lot about. And so, you know, I used that sort of the I call it the Twitter phenomenon. I thought, okay, well, let's try this out. I'll just tweet something once every few days. And then I thought, okay, well, I'll tweet something once a day, you know, either about gold or macro or Bitcoin, and just see what happens. And, you know, that also sucked me in. So I would say part of the process of falling down the rabbit hole, Twitter is a key part of that process.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely agree.
It's a very serious medium. I mean, I think it's one of those things that, especially among older people, you know, it's not always taken that seriously, especially because Trump uses it a lot and sometimes tweets things that are, you know, a little out there. But it's just like anything. People still think Bitcoin is connected to fraud and is for illegal activities or whatever it is. And those things keep people out of doing the deeper research and getting involved and really focusing on it. And it's like that with every bull market. They say bull markets climb a wall of worry. So people always find things to worry about. So, yeah.
Well, so speaking of Twitter, this just popped into my mind. And I absolutely agree with you that Twitter is, you know, it's where Bitcoiners live and where we, you know, hold discussions about how the protocol should evolve and about, economics and monetary policy and all that. And it's a serious medium. It's like you said, there's really serious conversations going on there. Yeah, of course, there's all kinds of other internet, you know, like the metaphorical, like, you know, cat memes and all that stuff too. But there are niches of Twitter where very serious conversations are happening that really do greatly affect the course of events in history.
There's no question. I mean, you know, you have someone like, I know that it's somewhat controversial, but you have someone like Vitalik on there, and it's unbelievable. He, you know, the in-depth kind of thoughts that he's communicating on Twitter. And the same goes for, you know, the equivalent on the Bitcoin side. You know, you've got Adam Back on Twitter. I mean, he's quoted twice in the white paper. You can actually send him a comment and he'll respond, and he's thoughtful. They're intellectual giants in the space, mm-hmm. and they're all connected here. And, there's no question. And, you know, I can't engage in that level of technical depth, but I read, you know, I'm reading all of that, just trying to suck it in and learn about it. But it's hard. It's not easy. But that just confirms to me how worthwhile it is.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. So Jack Dorsey, CEO of Twitter, this is what popped into my mind since we were talking about Twitter. He's also, of course, CEO of Square, which runs Cash App. Mm-hmm. He is a Bitcoin maximalist, it seems. He's at least Bitcoin-only guy. He toured Africa last year, did a lot of meetups with entrepreneurs. A lot of them were Bitcoin companies, entrepreneurs from Bitcoin companies. He seems to think that, Bitcoin has a, big role to play in the future of Africa. I talked with Ray Youssef last week, who is the CEO of Paxful, which is having a big impact in, Africa, especially in Nigeria. It's really interesting. What do you think about, how do you think Jack Dorsey is, how big of an influence do you think Jack Dorsey is for the future of Bitcoin?
Well, okay, well, that's a not a question I mean, it's a great question. And look, I think he's one of the leaders, certainly. I wouldn't necessarily say from the traditional world, but in a way, yes. And I think what he's doing is very important. And I believe he is a visionary. And he just, I think they just got accepted for a banking license. Is that correct? Or something
like
that?
That's what I heard. Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, look, it's not too crazy to think that he will build the first, Bitcoin bank, whatever that means. You know, it might mean, offering all the different services. I have no idea. You know, some people think, well, Bitcoin doesn't need that. You know, I get all that. I do think Bitcoin still needs a lot of explaining. It needs a better interface for people. It's got to become sort of more dummy-proof. And again, not your keys, not your Bitcoin. I get all that. And I think that's true. But that's going to be hard for the entire population. And, when you're trying to increase adoption in places, it helps to make things a little easier. Steve Jobs made things a little easier for people. Right. So I think he's certainly one of the leaders. And it makes sense. I've read a little bit about things going on in Africa. I'm not an expert, but it makes sense. They don't have established banking system. And Bitcoin really could be a savings platform for many people who, and even, a savings platform that pays interest. I think that's right. A remarkable thing. It's not really quite big enough yet, but, the borrowing and lending business is starting to pick up. You have guys like Compound, et cetera. You can make 5% on your Bitcoin. On my dollars, I'm making zero now. Right. And on my euro and on my yen, I'm making zero or negative. And, in Africa, holding certain currencies probably isn't a great idea. So to be able to hold Bitcoin at a 5% yield, I mean, that certainly would encourage savings, I would think, if they're, if they are producing a money beyond their needs. So I think, about 5-6 years ago, I read something. Julian Robertson, who I worked for in the early 90s, said, and he's in his late 80s now. He started Tiger Management, a big global macro hedge fund, actually a more equity-oriented hedge fund in the 80s. But he said, if I were a young man and I had 40 years ahead of me, I would be focusing on Africa. And so, there's tremendous opportunity there. I'm just not focused on the specifics.
Yeah, Ray Youssef was saying the same thing, that, Africa is really poised over the next several decades to really just kind of explode. And there's amazing entrepreneurs on the ground working there, and that Bitcoin is really helping, these entrepreneurs be able to, save, like you said, reserve their wealth, save their wealth, and really build their businesses on a, more sturdy foundation than they usually have.
Well, it's hard. I don't think that banking system really interacts with the Western one in a proper way. I mean, I think if you're a merchant in Nairobi and you need to send, let's say you want to send money to your cousin in Vancouver, I don't know, it probably goes through, and I'm not saying anything new, it probably goes through several different banks and intermediaries and problems and who knows what. Probably takes weeks. Whereas you could probably do it immediately, right?
Yep. Yeah.
So I agree with you, and I mean Dorsey is one of the leaders in the space. I think he's doing great work.
Agreed. Okay, so obviously you're into gold and Bitcoin. You know, other gold bugs like Peter Schiff, for instance, is kind of all in on gold and very anti-Bitcoin. You know, gold is better than Bitcoin. Bitcoin is, you know, worthless in various ways or doesn't have like inherent value. Do you think that Bitcoin and gold as commodities are complementary or competitive?
Well, you know, as you said, I own both. My gold business offers people the ability to. One of our subsidiaries was the first entity to offer BitPay. You could use BitPay to buy physical gold, so sell Bitcoin. I mean, that would have been a terrible trade, but you know, we offered that functionality in Q1 19. We were one of the first places where you could, we launched a product with Equity Trust that allowed for people to buy cryptocurrency in their IRAs. So not just Bitcoin, a handful of the other ones as well. So I believe it's hard money. Some people would argue it's the hardest money ever created. I can make that argument. I think gold is pretty hard. You know, it's difficult. It's expensive. You know, its equivalent proof of work algorithm is pretty difficult. So, yeah. So I don't know why Peter is so aggressively against Bitcoin. I mean, the reasons he uses are all reasons that have been discussed out there. I don't want to say they've been refuted one way or the other, but many of them have. It just strikes me that he's more of a salesman.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an investor. I don't, you know, I'm not particularly trying to sell anything to anyone. I like the Twitter platform. I like being engaged with the people there. I think that the people under sort of 35, 40 are the brightest people out there. You know, you don't find people that age involved in the markets who are of the same intellectual caliber. You just don't. I know because I've tried to hire analysts for the last 15 years in that space, and it's very hard. You just don't have the same caliber people. The interdisciplinary nature of understanding Bitcoin and digital assets and cryptocurrency and you know, forget all the ideological battles for a second. The people in the entire space are very high quality, and I don't know why, you know, Peter. Whereas in the gold space, I have to say there's very little talent. There are very few young people, certainly young people of extreme intelligence. You know, you won't find kids coming out of the best schools saying, "Hey, I want to go work for a gold miner," or "Hey, I want to go work at a gold storage business." That doesn't mean that it doesn't have value. It's just that I think Peter's position is a bit extreme, and I can only see that he takes it for, you know, reasons of salesmanship or getting attention. But you know what? That's fine too. People in the Bitcoin space should understand that. And if people in the Bitcoin space really were to do their work, they would see that there are people who are prominent in the gold space and certainly a lot more successful and a lot more prominent than Peter Schiff, who have different opinions. And on Real Vision last year, I interviewed John Hathaway, who was of Tocqueville Gold, but that company was bought by Sprott. One of the most thoughtful, intelligent guys in the space. He's over 70 years old, and he's open-minded towards Bitcoin. You know, he's a man who just before that interview I did with him had met with 60 different CEOs of mining companies. You know, he has a team that does in-depth research. He understands, you know, gold up and back and sideways, and So I'm more interested in the opinion of someone like John, or of course the next person who I interviewed, Tom Kaplan, who is an old friend of mine, billionaire himself in the gold space, much more interested to learn and listen to people like that than just someone who is trying to arouse people's emotion. And so, you know, Bitcoin people say, oh, do the work. When someone asks them a question about Bitcoin, I would shoot that back to people about the gold space, right? Like, do your work. Don't think that Peter Schiff represents the viewpoint of the most intelligent, successful people in the space.
Nice. Yeah, that makes sense. And this is, and what, you know, a great point that you bring up. It's another example of Bitcoin's gravity. It's attracting the best minds, or, you know, better minds than its kind of competing spaces. And I, you know, I see the same thing. One of the reasons that I love Bitcoin is that it's so intellectually stimulating. And I've said this before, but I think that I didn't realize that I was so intellectually bored before I found Bitcoin. And it's just really led to an education or re-education on so many different subjects. And that rabbit hole just branches off into so many different areas of learning. It's kind of amazing. So you mentioned this kind of the idea of this kind of generational shift, you know, between Bitcoin and gold, from gold to Bitcoin.
I didn't exactly say that.
Okay.
I didn't say there was a generational shift. I go ahead though. Finish your question.
Oh no, this is good. This is good. We can focus on this, because the way I took it was that, you know, you said the kind of the best minds, 30s, yes, early 40s people are really into Bitcoin, but not into gold. So I kind of interpreted that as a generational shift.
Well, yeah, no, I don't think it's a direct shift per se. I don't think, I think it's very difficult for people over 55 or so, from my background, to understand Bitcoin. It's very interdisciplinary, as you say. Usually older people have successful businesses or not, or they focused on what they have been focusing on for 25 years. And it just, there's no framework that's easy to drop Bitcoin in. It's its own thing. And you have to go back and read the white paper, and you've got to read literally hundreds of different viewpoints about it. You know, there's a lot of noise in the space. Sifting through the noise is difficult. And that's why something like, you know, Jan's book, which I mention often in Twitter, I like it for its simplicity. That's very important. So I think it's difficult for older people. And I think when you speak to people who are, let's say, 35 or younger, they intuitively just understand Bitcoin. I don't want to say almost right away, but they do. But gold, look, I've said this before, gold, you know, Bitcoin has the best track record in terms of price performance of any asset in the history of the world. It's, you know, depending how you, where you start, it's somewhere between 200 and 300% annualized for 10 years. You know, it's proven itself in my book. You don't find a 10-year track record like that anywhere. But gold has the longest track record, and it will have the longest track record of all time, and it will continue to into the future. You know, 1,000 years through 2,000 years, whatever the number is. So gold isn't going away. It's not going anywhere. I don't know even that the younger people might be more apt to own Bitcoin. But look, Bitcoin, people sometimes call it digital gold to give older people, I think, a way to think about it. And there are some attributes, but Bitcoin itself is much, much bigger than just digital gold. And I've talked about this in many places. You know, I didn't coin the phrase, but this concept of Bitcoin being a truth machine, being like an invention that eventually, you know, becomes the value protocol for the internet. That's much bigger than digital gold.
Right.
You know, its ability to replace SWIFT, which is a pre-internet thing, and ACH and all that stuff, that's much bigger than digital gold. So, you know, and there are a bunch of other things that other use cases for Bitcoin in the future that make it much bigger than that. So, look, if people understand Bitcoin by thinking about it in those terms, that's great. But it's a lot more than that.
Yeah, absolutely, so, it is.
So I would say, you know, to your question, I don't see like people dropping gold to buy Bitcoin. Older mm-hmm. people, I see maybe younger people just buying Bitcoin. But look, gold, I think just now is going to become a very important part of the I call legacy or traditional system. Mm-hmm. I don't see things just going away. I mean, some people think that, okay, our system, the legacy system, has got problems and it's just going to go, it's going to stop one day and then we're going to replace it with Bitcoin. It doesn't work that way. It's going to take years of transition. And within the traditional system, you know, you have bonds now, government bonds, yielding close to zero everywhere. And so what's happened is we've lost a productive asset class for traditional investors. So many institutional investors have what's called a 70-30 portfolio, 70 equity or growth assets and 30% bonds or hedge type assets. But now bonds, as they approach zero, start to not really have the ability to hedge the asset side of your portfolio. And in a period where things are slowing and the authorities are pumping in massive liquidity and debasing the currency, bonds can't really rally that much through the zero. I don't think you'll have institutions and insurance companies and everyone in the world buying bonds at minus 50 basis points. It just makes no sense. But gold, I think, will become much more sensitive to those additions of liquidity and has an unlimited upside in theory. There's no cap to it. There's no zero bound. In theory, gold prices can double in an environment where the Fed is injecting huge liquidity and the dollar is dropping, all of that to stabilize asset market. So gold still has a very, very important role to play for institutional investors. And it's also a $10 trillion market. Bitcoin is just not big enough at the moment. Even if it goes up 10 times, you know, even if it goes up 50 times, it's not going to be big enough for, you know, for the world's institutions to get a big enough allocation. Mm-hmm. I think eventually it could be, and there are certain paths of events where Bitcoin is taken up more quickly and becomes much bigger more quickly. But even for me, that's not really a base case. And I think it's going to 300,000-400,000. So, you know, right. And, yeah. But I don't see a wholesale rejection of the old and taking in of the new that happens overnight. It's a transition that'll happen over the next, you know, 10, 15 years.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's pretty quick, actually, relatively speaking. Okay. So I saw this Market Insider article. Of course, Market Insider is a publication of Business Insider. And it led with the headline, Bitcoin price skyrockets 23% as investors look for a new safe haven. Had a couple bullet points below it. Investors have seen central banks worldwide pump large amounts of fiat currency into the global economy, depressing prices. There are only 21 million Bitcoin in existence, making it a relative safe haven for investors. It's kind of amazing for me to read these narratives at the very top of a Market Insider article. Do you hear, kind of these rumblings of these narratives that Bitcoiners have been, you know, sharing for quite a while now, being picked up in the mainstream media and, you know, with your, you know, colleagues in the, as you put it, legacy financial system?
Yeah, look, it's not big enough to be a real safe haven. Is it a safe haven? You know, I hate using these descriptions that we've been using forever. You know, mm-hmm. the yen used to be a safe haven. Treasuries are a safe haven. Gold is a safe haven. I think Bitcoin is its own thing. I mean, Bitcoin is an invention, right? It's like saying, is electricity a safe haven? Mm-hmm. You know, after it was invented. It's somewhat of a safe haven because it's an alternative to the existing system. You know, Raul calls it a call on the future. You know, which is right. A safe haven, yeah, it's sort of a safe haven just because, but look what happened. It got, there are people in the traditional world, who have positions, and they have positions in futures markets. People are massively leveraged. And when there's a liquidation event of all assets in the world, it gets hit.
Right.
So, but that to me doesn't mean it's not a safe haven. It's definitely an alternative. But, you know, to try to, you know, put it into, you know, the language of, you know, the traditional markets, it's not accurate. Mm-hmm. It's just like saying Bitcoin is digital gold. That's not accurate. So this is all terminology from the old world, right?
Right.
And in a way prevents people from doing the real digging, because someone will say, oh, you know, Bitcoin is now, it went down when the markets dropped, so it's not a safe haven, which is a completely ridiculous thing to say. It, of course, it's an alternative. You know, how are you defining safe haven? If safe haven means it goes up anytime there's any turmoil, well, then it's not a safe haven. But that's not, you know, no one should be trading Bitcoin as a replacement for bonds or gold, right? It should be an allocation in your portfolio because it's the most asymmetric bet that exists today. Mm-hmm. And it certainly has been the most asymmetric bet, successful bet of all time. I mean, no asset has done what it's done over the last 10 years. So, you know, I think people just, I don't know how they can ignore that. 10 years is a long time. It's, you know, it's a strong asset. I tweeted something the other day, you know, all this government intervention, Bitcoin went down 50% a day and then stabilized. It was at 5,000. And people are complaining it's not a safe haven, it's not this or that. And it stabilized without government intervention, without injections of this or that. Yep. It's building strength, right?
Right. It's anti-fragile.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I don't love that Taleb sort of framework, but whatever.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think those narratives that sort of appropriate or try to compare Bitcoin to these legacy financial terms is an effort from Bitcoiners to try to speak to, you know, people who are familiar with the legacy system. But I absolutely agree with you also, on the other hand, that it's kind of misleading. And so if you establish Bitcoin as digital gold or a safe haven in someone's mind, then they might have a more difficult time understanding what it really is. Yeah.
Right. So that's the problem, is that someone from the traditional world will just say, oh, it was supposed to be a safe haven, it isn't, it doesn't work. Or, oh, it's not digital gold. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that. And so you turn a lot of people off with these overly simplistic, descriptions. Now, that being said, you got to start somewhere, right? Meaning you got to start somewhere in terms of creating the language for people to understand what it is. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. You know, but I don't call it any of those things, nor do I refer to it that way. And I, so I, yeah.
When you're describing it to somebody from the legacy financial industry, who you've worked with in the past, or just an acquaintance of yours from that industry, how do you describe it to them?
Yeah, I describe it to them as a as an invention akin to the invention of electricity.
Right.
It's not. It's a. You know. It's a once in 50 to whatever 100 year event, and I say, look, it's the result of and culmination of 30 years of cryptographic research and development. You know, I think the white paper is a scientific paper, right? And so in that way, look, a lot of people in my world, you know, they hear, oh, Satoshi, and who is it? It's made up, and what is it? And it, for whatever reason, if you don't really dig into it, just its image is that it's kind of a joke in a way, which, you know, it isn't at all. I mean, the paper solves the Byzantine general's problem. Mm-hmm. And that was a problem that hadn't been solved for a long time, yeah, for centuries in theory. And so you have to explain to people that it's that, right? You have to get down to sort of the brass tacks. You know, it's a decentralized system of trust, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's certain phrases like that I use to show them. You know, it's two parties are able to trust each other without an intermediary now.
Right.
Right? Because it's all, but it is more like a machine, though. I feel like when I think about the apparatus of Bitcoin capital B, the entire functioning of the Bitcoin network and how it works, it's super complicated to me. How consensus is achieved. And when you really get into the nitty gritty, it's complicated. Yeah. But it is a functioning machine, you know, turning electricity into security. People don't understand that. They see the price going up and down, and someone says it's digital gold, and someone responds, oh, it's not digital gold, and that's it. They're not thinking that it's, you know, a contraption that turns electricity into security, right? It's the most secure system that exists, that's ever existed. What is that worth? What is a system like that worth, right?
Yeah.
I think that when I explain it in those terms, people start to say, oh, well, I haven't heard that before. I heard safe haven and then I turned it off.
Yeah.
And so they don't realize that, you know, it's an epic discovery.
Right.
And so that's how I try to explain it to people, to take it out of, what might be, you know, a traditional way to think about it.
Yeah, I love that, man. I love that. I think that that's a really important message, and I'm glad that you're sharing it here so listeners can chew on it, but it makes a lot of sense to me. So, all right, I want to turn back to this financial crisis a little bit. You know, we're having all kinds of work shutdowns now. Obviously, spending is going way down. People are self-quarantining. Restaurants, bars being shut down. Schools being shut down. Trump mentioned, I think it was last or just a few days ago, he mentioned 20% unemployment as a possibility, this thing dragging out for months, maybe years. How bad can this get? I mean, this seems to me like a recipe for, a very, very bad financial crisis like we haven't seen in a very long time.
Yeah. You've said it. The best economists I know are now forecasting GDP minus 20% in the second quarter. Mm-hmm. And unemployment claims next week are slated to go up over 1 million. I think that's the number. And it's just much higher and worse than I think we've ever seen. It's a matter of speed as well. So there are periods when the unemployment rate has been higher. And I think, oh, wait, we got to almost 10%. We were at 3 and change, and we'll probably be at 5 in short order, but I think it's the speed of contraction that we've never, ever seen. So the virus, in my opinion, and I'm not a doctor, but in my opinion, the virus damage, economic damage, will be multiples of what the health damage will be. So far, 8,000 people have died. I think that's unfortunate around the world. But naturally, every day, 159,000 people die. And the fact that China is showing very few new cases. I know people say China's lying about their data. You know, you have to take it at face value what it is. It's 3,000 people dead in China. You have 3,000 people dead in Italy. And in Italy, it's supposed to be, you know, it's even worse than in China, but it's still only 3,000 people. And we've basically taken our economy to zero. You know, the clients, I posted something last night that, you know, diners at restaurants in the major cities in the last week has dropped 100% or 98%. Yeah. So we've never, ever seen anything like this in the U.S. economy, ever, including the Depression. We've gone to zero within a span of a week or two. So, you know, people who are saying, government shouldn't be intervening, shouldn't be spending money, they're totally nuts. The Fed, the PBOC, the ECB, they should all be in the markets attempting to provide as much liquidity as possible to stabilize the markets. There should be massive fiscal spending, probably to the tune, certainly of 10% of GDP immediately to offset things. Yeah. I mean, these are big numbers, and they should be done in coordination with the other major blocs, Europe and Asia. So I think it's bad, but look, in any crisis, you have moments where there are also recoveries. You know, so maybe there'll be a point here where things will get bad enough and then the authorities respond and then we can have a period of reprieve for 6 months. You know, the markets will move to price in a very bad situation. And then, you know, maybe we can have a reprieve for a few months. You know, but I think people are just waiting for the cases to crest.
Yeah.
The virus cases to crest. I would say, honestly, it affects older people more. I know there's talk that it affects everybody, but it's really the older people who are over 70. You know, people at risk, we can quarantine. I think a big chunk of the population should go back to work. I know, you know, I think we need to do it in a controlled and planned way. But, you know, we're moving away from sort of my expertise and what I think I'm really qualified to talk about. Which is, you know, the markets, the impact of what's going on, and macro on wealth and investment.
Yeah, I really just was really interested in getting your take on how the, you know, this virus and pandemic and quarantine will affect the markets. And I think you did a great job answering that there. We're coming up on time here. I think we're in good shape in terms of just tons of great takes here from you and a lot of good information. I think Bitcoiners will really appreciate it. So thanks for your time, Dan, and I you know, hope you stay safe out there.
You too. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Thanks to Dan for joining me. It was a real pleasure to speak with Dan, and you know, it was just a very timely conversation with everything that's going on in the macro landscape. Really impressed with everything that Dan's done and really happy to have him on Team Bitcoin. Let us know your thoughts about the episode. Dan is at DTAPCAP, DTAPCAP, and I am at Citizen Bitcoin on the Bitcoin Twitter. And that is the best way to support the podcast. Share it out on Bitcoin Twitter. Comment, let us know what you thought. Share it with your family and friends. Podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. Thanks again to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring this episode. Truly excited that this product is rolling out. It's in your hands next week, open to everyone. It's exciting. Thanks to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the Citizen Bitcoin podcast in their feed. Follow on Twitter at LTB Network. And you can subscribe to their feed. There's several other Bitcoin-only podcasts there as well. Don't forget to check out the merch shop at layer1btc.com. You can click on partners and then choose Citizen Bitcoin. Shout out to Nick Ward, great Bitcoiner, who is also a great designer. There's cool stuff there, including my favorite design, the Unfuck the Money shirt, which, you know, you could rock right now, and I think you'd get a lot of questions considering what's going on out there and how prominent the fuckage of the money is in the mainstream media right now. If you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. My DMs are open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram and Keybase. My email address is citizenbitcoin@pm.me. This week's open source shout out is, of course, again, Bitcoiners Best. We curate the best Bitcoin content to get new coiners up to speed and keep Bitcoiners up to date. This is all done with your help. You can 1x your vote for free, 10x your vote for 10k sats. All the sats are donated to Bitcoin open source projects. Just submit your favorite stuff. You know, come across a thread you love, head over to bitcoiners.best and toss it in there. We'll make sure it's Bitcoin only, and it'll show up on the site, and then Bitcoiners can vote it up. And the best stuff, the cream of the crop, the cream will rise to the top. All right, so that's it, I guess, for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.